Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Welcome back to Origin Story, a semi-regular interview series on post-show recaps made possible by the patrons of post-show recaps. In each episode, it's me and a different guest in the pop culture space, digging into their origins, the movies and shows and journey through life that brought them to where they are now. This week, I'm joined by a titan in the entertainment journalism world, Leslie Goldberg, the West Coast TV editor at The Hollywood Reporter, the co-host of the must-listen television industry podcast TV's Top 5, and my assigning editor at THR. If you've enjoyed any of my THR stuff from over the last 5 years, you can thank Leslie for all of that, not to mention for tolerating all the podcasts I've been doing around these parts as well. For anyone who's interested in journalism generally and entertainment journalism specifically, as well as the current state of the TV landscape, Leslie is as vital a resource as they come. So with that said, it's my pleasure to invite you to listen in on Leslie Goldberg's origin story. Hi, Leslie.
Hey, Josh.
Hi, how are ya?
I'm good, man. Thanks for having me on your show. This is awesome.
I'm so nervous.
Any opportunity to talk to you, my friend. Yeah, I'm going to say my friend like 17 times.
Oh, my God. Well, we say hello, friend, around these parts. We used to say it more regularly when we had Mr. Robot coverage here on Post Show. But hello, friend, is what I will say to you, Leslie. As we are both wearing hoodies, you know, or at least we can go hoodie up for
there
the time
go.
Being. Yeah,
there channeling we go. Our Mr. Robot.
Yes.
There we go.
How are you doing? It's a Friday. Is this a busy day for you in the trenches of the entertainment reporting gig?
It's been. I'm gonna say it's a little slow today, but then I'm gonna knock on wood because every time you actually say it's slow, some massive story drops. But yeah. You know, Quibi just shut down, so it feels like there's the biggest story of the week. Yeah. The last presidential debate last night, it feels like everyone's just exhausted. So hopefully the news cycle is going to show a little bit of a blessing today.
Yeah.
And
We'll see. All right. I am so happy that you said yes to this. I have to tell you, I was really nervous to ask you onto the podcast.
That's ridiculous.
I was like, genuinely, well, because like we're very close. We've worked together very closely for it'll be 5 years. So by the time that this podcast comes out, this podcast is coming out the day before my 5 year anniversary of my first byline at the Hollywood Reporter.
And 5 years ago, my life was made infinitely better. Oh. My job was made infinitely easier by adding you to the ranks, Josh.
The reason why
happy anniversary.
The reason, well, I appreciate it and thank you, and very big vice versa. But the biggest reason why I'm nervous is like now you are like being brought into the world of like my really goofy, stupid podcast antics, and so I am afraid that like now you're gonna find out who I really am.
He's out. I have long admired your podcast skills, Josh, and as someone who's been doing this, you know, Dan Feinberg and I were just you know, on Slack a few minutes ago as we were planning for our 100th episode of TV's Top 5. And
are you up to 100 episodes already?
Yeah, towards the end of the year. Yeah, we'll be at 100. Man. But you've done, I don't know, what is it, thousands of episodes now. And
I don't want to think about it.
I'm just so beyond impressed. You know, like I remember our first podcast recording for TV's Top 5. I think you can go back and listen to it. My voice was shaky and I was completely intimidated and honestly, every Friday morning I wake up and think like, God, did I say anything stupid? Did I mispronounce someone else's name? Because I'm awful at that. So
you and I talk a lot about like anxiety stuff, and I'm very open with you about the things that I go through. And like, I don't know how much I've talked to you about this, but like the one thing, like one of like, if there are like three things that have been like positive about this period of time, it's how virtual we've become. Because I can do this. I can, like, this is where I live. Like, I live in like the virtual conversation space. Like, this is old hat for me. So the moderating gigs, like, can they all be online now? Like that, the butterflies go away for that one for me.
Moderating still gives me the shakes and the sweats.
Yeah.
I will never get comfortable doing that. Yeah. I moderated at San Diego Comic Con last year, which was like a bucket list item, but oh man, never again.
At Hall H?
Hell no. Hall H. It was like room like 6 BCF for Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Which is one of my all time favorite shows. But that moderating Comic Con is, that's like,
that would be fun to do.
Pinnacle of anxiety for me.
I would make sure I'm properly medicated and I'd be ready to go.
One and done for me, please.
All right. So Leslie, this is your post-show recaps premiere, but you are a legend in the entertainment reporting space. You absolutely are. Don't make a face at me. It is the truth.
I'm making a face at you.
You're making a face at me. And somebody whose name I knew long before I got to know you as a friend and as a colleague. But you know, as we like to describe sort of the roles that we have, like you do a lot of industry facing reporting. I do a lot of consumer facing reporting. And I think that Posha Recaps is very much consumer facing. Like we don't really get into the industry weeds all that much. And when we do, it's often because like, it's just something that like you can't not talk around. So people might be here listening to you for the first time on this podcast. So with that in mind, who are you and what are you all about? What do you do? Why did I ask you to be on this podcast, would you say?
That's a great question. I'm only guessing because you it's been a while since we've had the time to actually kind of just sit down and shoot the shit and just gossip and catch up and talk about life and not work stuff. But for work stuff, I'm the West Coast TV editor at The Hollywood Reporter. I oversee the live feed blog, which contains a lot of our breaking TV news, industry analysis, and all of your fine, fine contributions, Josh, all the consumer stuff. So if you're a TV fan, you bookmark not just THR.com, but live feed as well. And I've been at THR. Early September was my 18 year anniversary. Amazing. With The Hollywood Reporter. And I actually started there way back in 2003 as a copy editor.
Yeah.
So it's been a long time coming, and I had a brief 3 month spell of fun employment, as I called it, during the recession in 2009. And it's working at THR has absolutely changed my life, changed my career. And it's part of the fabric of who I am when you especially when you talk about being at one job for nearly 20 years, even though the job has changed considerably from what it first was.
We were talking the other day before we did this, and I was saying like one of the reasons why this is so fun for me is like I feel like I know a lot about you, but maybe not timeline wise of like where you start to where you are right now. So I would love to chart that a little bit. You're California born and raised.
LA baby.
LA
go
baby.
Dodgers.
What was young Leslie like? Give me like the snapshot of growing up in LA. Yeah,
well,
lifelong
one of my
Dodgers
moms.
Fan, very famous. Famously, if you know anything about Leslie, you know that you are the top Dodgers fan on the planet.
I disagree with that, but I hear what you're saying. But my mom likes to show this picture of me that I think really encapsulates everything. I think I was like 5 or 6. I'm wearing a Star Wars t-shirt. Behind me is like a Disneyland poster of like a whole bunch of different characters. And in my hands are those giant 12-inch Star Wars figures that like every kid in the 70s and early 80s had. And I'm not talking like the 2 or 3 inch action figures. I'm talking about the giant Princess Leia, whose hair you could never get back in those buns. entertainment, movies, TV. Really was my first love out, right up there with baseball. As a kid, the minute I saw Happy Days and Fonzie flip up his collar, I was just in love with the medium. And, as an only child, that was my babysitter, that was my best friend, and especially as someone who was completely sheltered and was just completely intimidated by people and didn't have, like, I was not very outgoing. I was incredibly shy as a kid and young adult. And it was just like, I kind of found who, what life was and who I wanted to be from watching TV. And when I saw Happy Days, and Henry Winkler knows this, we had him on TV Stuff Live, right. And I've gotten to interview him numerous times in my career. And at the end of the first interview, I kind of told him how much that show meant to me, because it showed that even, you know, the coolest people can find the nerdiest people and get along. And it just made me just feel comfortable and confident in who I was. And then, of course, when I was 20, I came out and I was like, oh, wow. Yeah, that's really who I am.
Yeah.
And that's when everything kind of started falling into place. I was a journalism student at Cal State Northridge, go Matadors. And as soon as I kind of figured out, like, back in the day, I wanted to, you know, to do broadcasting. But for someone who was a shy introvert,
when did you being feel a like broadcast that was,
is terrifying.
When did you feel like that was something you wanted to do? Pretty early?
High school, really. Yeah. You know, I did, like, you know, morning announcements once, you know, for a friend. I'd begged my friend who did them every morning to let me, you know,
put me in. Yeah.
Like, come on, put me in, coach, you know, and, you know, we actually knew each other from the softball team, which that'll be the gayest thing I say during this interview, possibly, until I talk about my gay wife.
Yes.
You know, but, you know, so she put me in one day and I just flubbed it in the worst possible way. And my dreams of being the female version of Vin Scully were just shattered. And I was like, yeah, okay. So, my mom was an English major. I'm going to go that route. I'm going to, like, focus on writing. And, I went to CSUN as a journalism major on day one. And that's, you know, I love the medium. I love writing. And over my career at THR, I've been incredibly lucky to get to wear a lot of different hats, both as a copy editor, which is how I started, and eventually working my way up to writing and reporting. And now it's like, you know, for me, it's like the way my life has evolved has been, the more comfortable that I get with myself, the more able I am to put myself out there. And that means talking to agents and showrunners and actors and, you know, people who run this industry that, you know, 15 years ago, I would have been too intimidated to even talk to, let alone have as a guest on our show or, you know, but yeah, it helps a lot. And we've talked about this a lot too, Josh, when you can say that you love what you do. And I love what I do. I met my wife doing this job, and I can't imagine what I would be doing if I wasn't writing and reporting about television.
Yeah. One of the jobs that I want to get into even before The Hollywood Reporter, because you often mention this to me, is that you worked in a comic book store, right?
Yeah.
Once upon a time. Tell me the story. Yeah.
So my very first job, I was 14 years old. I was and still am an avid baseball card collector. And there was this shop that used to be on Pico called Golden Apple Comics. It's part of a bigger chain. It used to have three different stores in Southern California here. And I walked in and they had a baseball card counter. And there was a sign on the counter that just said, looking for, you know, a baseball card assistant. And so at 14, I applied and got the job. I got paid $2.50 an hour to sort cards in the back room. And after about 2 months, and I built about 40 sets of 1988 Tops, which, if you remember, if you know the hobby, it's worth about $5 now. And after about a month or two of being in the back room sorting cards, I worked my way up to being behind the counter. And all of a sudden it just kind of clicked into, like, I know my stuff. People kept and stopped asking, like, oh, is there a guy here who knows what they're doing with baseball cards, kind of thing.
Right.
And yeah, so I did all the baseball cards at Golden Apple, and you can't work there and not learn about comics. And so I worked there until I was about 19 or 20. And then I went to work at Beverly Hills Baseball Card Shop. And I did that all the way through college and a little after graduation until I wound up working at The Hollywood Reporter when I started in 2003.
So how did you get involved in THR in the first place? What was your first job there?
So my very first job there was a copy editor, and I applied. I saw an ad on, like, way back on journalismjobs.com in, like,
and you're already a journalism student at this point. This is already your path. Yeah.
Yeah. I had graduated from CSUN in 1998 and worked a couple of odd jobs here and there afterwards.
What was the oddest? What was the weirdest thing you did?
Well, my first job out of college was I was the calendar and obituaries editor at the Jewish Journal. And
oh, wow.
If you have a degree in journalism, the running gag, or at least it used to be, is your first job, you will edit obituaries.
Yeah.
And that wound up being true for me. I was at the Jewish Journal for all of 3 weeks. And then I got another job offer that I was a full-time copy editor because I had done all of that kind of stuff in college, where I was the editor-in-chief of our daily college newspaper, the Daily Sundial. And I was at the Jewish Journal for 3 weeks and then wound up being a copy editor at this place called Pool Publications, which published a series of outdoor magazines. So it was like Camping Life and like boating magazines. I can't remember the titles of all of them. I was there for 8 months because I was commuting from Northridge to Carson, which is, you know, if you're in Southern California, that's 2.5 hours each way on the 405 in Gridlock.
Oh, man.
And yeah, that's
with,
like
with
the definition of road.
Without traffic.
Oh, with traffic.
Yeah,
it's the definition of road rage.
Yeah.
And then after that, you know, I had been fed up with the commute. You know, there were not a lot of people there with journalism degrees, and I just couldn't function in a place where fishing and boating expertise trumped journalism, because that was, I am the opposite of someone who's interested in fishing and boating. But I called my advisor from CSUN, and one of my old professors who got me in, who recommended me for a job at the Daily Sundial, where I wound up starting as a copy editor and rising all the way to managing editor and editor in chief. And I called her and I just said, I can't do this anymore. What are you hearing? Is there anything out there? And they're like, well, the LA Daily News is looking for a copy editor. And I was like, oh my God, that's a real journalism job. It's not, you know, I'm not editing stories about hitches and trailer boats, which I had to Google what a hitch was. I didn't know.
I'm trying not to multitask right now, but
no, yeah,
I'm tempted.
You can laugh. It's good. And anyway, I called her up and she got me an interview, recommended me, you know, sent them some of my, you know, it helped that the person who was doing the hiring at the LA Daily News was a CSUN grad who had a relationship with one of my old journalism professors, who wound up running and eventually becoming the department chair of journalism and taking it on and rising through the ranks at CSUN. And that got me the interview. I got in and took the copy editing test and met with a bunch of people, got a call back for a secondary interview, and then wound up getting the job. And that transformed my life. I started working nights. My shifts were like 3 to midnight, editing everything from, you know, on the news section, from A1 stories to helping out in sports to helping out in features, because, you know, as someone who loves arts and entertainment, that's where my passion was. Like, I remember when American Idol first launched and they wanted to put like a photo on page one with like a little pointer, to turn to page, you know, whatever. The story, they're like, oh, give it to Leslie. She's like the youngest one on the copy desk by like 20 years. Or anytime there was like an award show, right? Emmys, Oscars, SAG, Globes, whatever. You know, they always had me edit because they knew that that was all content
that
I consume.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I did that for about 3 years and I was still working at the baseball card shop. If it tells you anything, my old boss at the time, I told him, I'm like, I really need Saturdays off. Which for someone who's coming into the copy desk, Saturdays and Sundays are days where you're not going to get off because you're the new kid on the block and those go to the people who with experience. And he agreed to give me Saturdays off, but I had to have split days, which no one wants split days off, right? So he asked me, well, which weekday do you want off? And I said, Wednesdays, because new episodes of Dawson's Creek were on. So if that shows you my priorities at
yeah,
the time.
Yeah. So yeah, you had Saturdays and Wednesdays were your...
So Saturdays and Wednesdays. And I worked at the baseball card shop all day on Saturday and Wednesdays. And I worked Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday at the baseball card shop, 11 to 2. And then I went from Beverly. So I started in Sherman Oaks when I was living in Sherman Oaks. I did Sherman Oaks to Beverly Hills to work at the card shop from 11 to 2, and then Beverly Hills out to Woodland Hills to work until about midnight at the Daily News. And I did that for about 3 years.
How did you do that? How did you?
I was in my
20s,
man.
How did you survive
that?
How did you do that? That's crazy. All right. So you were working.
I put a lot of miles on a pickup truck. That's all
I
remember.
Yeah. That car got used. So that's like, 12, 13 hour work days you were doing? Yeah. Plus, would you, was that commute your lunch break? Would you be able to take any breaks during the...
I would stop at home because mm-hmm. in the middle of all of that, there was about a month-long period where one of my cats was really sick and needed meds through a feeding tube. So I would kind of stop at home and do that and then have like a Zone bar and a Red Bull in the car on the way out to Woodland Hills.
Oh my God. So that was
healthy eating habits I have. Yeah.
Yes. Well, sometimes, you know, you do what you got to do. So yeah. You eat on the fly. Why was it so important you to still be working at the baseball card shop?
I had to make ends meet, you know, yeah. This is, you know, copy editor jobs didn't pay a lot. I think my early salary, I remember being so excited that I was getting a regular check. And I think my annual salary was something like $24,000 a year for the Daily News.
Yeah.
And I was making, I think, $10 an hour at the card shop.
Yeah.
And of course, I'd, you know, spend some of it at the card shop. So.
Yeah. Yeah. So how does the pivot to THR begin? Because that's where you're going to be riding for the duration from there.
Well, working nights and, as you pointed out, 12 and 13 hour days and driving, you know, all around Southern California, you know, it took a toll. I was young and single and all my friends were, you know, going out to concerts or going out drinking and, you know, on dates. And, you know, I was young and single and, you know, wound up being the designated driver when my roommate and our friends wound up having too much to drink. So I'd go from Woodland Hills on like a Friday night out to West Hollywood and, you know, maybe have one drink before last call. And then I'd basically drive all these drunk fools home.
Yeah. You'd hear about the good night.
Yeah. And you'd hear the stories. Yeah. So I wound up, you know, looking around on journalismandjobs.com and saw that the Hollywood Reporter was hiring. And I, like I said, I've loved TV specifically since I was little, and my mom was a big sci-fi fan, is still a huge sci-fi fan. It's one of the things that my mom and my wife wound up bonding over with the first time that they met. And I wound up applying for the job. I didn't get it. They kept my resume on file, and then a similar post opened up and they called me in, and this was more dedicated copy editor, because the other job was like copy editing and working the wires a little bit, which I had done at the Daily News, you know, covering like the September 11th attacks and a lot of that other stuff and, you know, all the major breaking stories. And so they called me back for the second interview for the copy editing job. And I remember the interview was with the managing editor at the time, a guy named Dave Morgan, one of the best journalism guys you'll meet. And he asked me after the copy editing test, he's like, you know, tell me, you know, what's your weakness? And I was just like, you know what? I'm honest and blunt to the point. I said, I am an awful speller and I'm applying here and doing an interview for a copy editing job. But the fact that I know that that's my weakness, I wind up working harder to make sure that I get things right.
Yeah.
And I got the job.
That's awesome.
And that was 2003.
A trapdoor question.
It really is. It really is a tricky question.
Yeah. So you're on the copy desk, and what's the day-to-day like from there for the next little while, now that you've pivoted over to THR? Had you been reading The Hollywood Reporter?
I read everything online. You know, if it was anything to do with movies or television, just casting stuff. I love casting stories. I loved understanding what the new TV shows were and why, obviously watching trailers like a lot of big fans do. You know, and I had my favorite shows and reading about all of them and what was going on. And that was kind of at the birth of, you know, the recap movement. And a lot of that stuff was kind of starting to launch and to come into play. And, but yeah, I mean, my day to day, this is when I left, I stopped working, during the day and the weekends at a baseball card shop. So I was down to one job. This is me celebrating working, you know, 8 or 8.5 hours a day. 5 days a week now. Fairly normal shift. Yeah. Well, my day started, my shift was from noon to eight.
Okay.
So a lot better than,
that's an upgrade,
you know, three to midnight and a second job in the mornings. But yeah, I would go in around noon and, you're reading stories for THR. So that means editing reviews, casting stories, film stories, business stories, box office. You know, and the more that I was there, the more that you know, I wanted to do more. So I volunteered to edit the business page. And I remember working with our business editor, a guy named George Salai, who's still one of our great international correspondents now based in London at THR Today. And George and I would talk every morning. And he's like, oh, these are the biz stories. And I would like, oh, we should do an earnings chart with, you know, to accompany this and this and blah, blah, blah. And I just remember reading about like Netflix stock and being like, oh, you know, it's like $3 a share. I should buy some of that. I'm like, I wish I made more money and play the stock market a little bit. Yeah. It's like at $500 a share now or something.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Hindsight. Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a dream job, you know, being at THR and getting to read about how the sausage gets made, how films get made, how TV shows get made, and working with some people that I had read for a long time. You know, THR used to have an incredible staff, right? Still has an amazing staff. But when you look around the industry, Nelly Andreeva, it was our TV editor, and she obviously, you know, is a huge name at Deadline, one of the co-founders of Deadline.com. Cynthia Littleton, who was just this week was promoted to co-editor-in-chief of Variety. You know, these are two of my mentors, and getting to work with them on the daily basis and editing their stories and learning about the business through being their editor or their copy editor. I wasn't their editor. I was their copy editor.
Right.
And, you know, that's where I got to learn about upfronts, you know, when all the advertisers pitch their new shows to, or when all the networks pitch their new shows to the advertisers, and how to write a casting story and what a put pilot means. And it was what an overall deal was, and just, I loved it. It was like a peek behind the curtain of one of my favorite things. And it was pretty great.
Yeah. I think being, literally having it be your job, like you have to read every single thing, you know?
Oh, you have to read every single thing about all these things, you know, that you love so much, and find out that certain people on staff don't know how to spell Steve Carell's name right, or Reese Witherspoon's name right every day.
Right.
Yeah. You know, like,
yeah. Yeah, so that's, I mean, it's like kind of, it's its own continuation of journalism school. It's like a specification, you know, like you're getting to have that like upfront, look at how all of this is getting made from the people you'd been reading for so long.
Yeah. It was absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have traded it for the world. And, I remember how shattered I was. As high as those highs were, I remember one day coming in, this is the middle of the recession, I want to say 2009, and, you know, journalism was in the toilet because everything was going online. And I remember going in early because I was working on, I had just the night before gotten assigned this like special year-end project, and I was kind of mapping it out. So I had come in 2 hours early to kind of work on this package. And, you know, the guy I worked with on that biz stuff, George, was based in New York at the time. So the time difference, it made it a little easier. And we had this whole thing planned out, and I had drawn up some charts and had ideas and mapped out what the page design was going to look like, and had a meeting set up with the art department. And then I got a call from HR, and I was like, what's going on? And then I got laid off.
Yeah.
And I was like, it felt like I got hit by a truck.
Yeah.
Financially unprepared. Just emotionally, obviously unprepared. Nothing can prepare you for that. I don't think anyone even knew that layoffs were coming at THR at that time.
Yeah.
And yeah, I went to a bar around the corner, Luna Park, RIP Luna Park on La Brea, and with a couple of colleagues that also got laid off that day. And we had a couple of drinks and then sobered up and went home. And then I kind of just sat there in front of my computer and like, what the hell do I do now? And it was a low point. And I was just like, how am I going to pay my bills? You know, I don't want to go back to working at a card shop. That's not going to pay the bills. I need to stay in journalism. What do I do? What do I do next?
Yeah.
And I started freelancing. I got really, really lucky and sent, you know, resumes with clips and story ideas to a friend who worked at a website called SheWired.com, which is owned by the publishers of The Advocate and a couple other places. And I had some friends who knew that I was a journalism nut, and they recommended me for a lot of like LGBTQ freelance opportunities. And I just started saying yes to any and every job that came through. And I just started freelancing left and right. And SheWired at that time was really growing what they were doing, and they wanted someone with a focus on entertainment to write about the intersection of LGBTQ stuff in TV and movies. And hi, that's me. And I was writing 5 or 6 stories a day for something like $20 a piece or something like that, just because it gave me experience of writing casting stories or recapping Grey's Anatomy or finding a different angle and stuff. And I was interviewing a lot of like LGBTQ comedians and really just kind of building up a footprint in that community while also getting some experience as a writer, which I hadn't done since my days in college when I was a staff writer and copy editor and business editor and wire editor and managing editor and then editor in chief.
Yeah.
And
because I was going to ask at this point in this time. So it's 2003 when you're starting at THR, and then it's 2009 when you're laid off. Were you just straight copy editing?
I was straight copy editing when I was laid off. Yeah. I was 100% dedicated copy editor. And I remember the copy desk we had at our old building. It was a literal row of our copy desk. And I look back at that and it's like Patrick Hipes, who's now the managing editor at deadline.com, Kimberly Nordyke, who is now the managing editor of THR.com, Dara Head, who is still on the copy desk at THR, and Tatiana Siegel, who's now a film editor at THR, like Eric Peterson, who was one of our slot editors. If you're a copy editor, you're either a rim or a slot. Slot's like the you know, more managey position on the copy desk. And Eric Peterson's over at a high ranking guy, Muckety Muck at Deadline too. And you know, that was a murderer's row of talent who are all still in the biz, and all just lucky enough. I've been lucky enough to work with and still call Dara and Kimberly. I get to call them colleagues and friends, dear friends, you know. But yeah, so that was 2009 when I got laid off and then started freelancing. And I wound up applying for any kind of journalism job that I could get. And I remember going in, I went in for an interview. This is perhaps my lowest moment in my career.
Oh, no.
I don't know if you know this.
I'm not sure where you're going, so I don't know.
I applied for a job as a managing editor of adult video news. Yeah.
Oh, no, Leslie, no.
So I drove to Van Nuys. Of course, they're based in Van Nuys, right? Or they were at the time. I don't know where they are now. I do not pay attention to adult video news. So I go out to Van Nuys, porn capital of the world, and do have this meeting. And I'm just like, don't touch anything. Don't touch anything. Like, it was not the job that I wanted, but it would have been a job that had managing editor in the title would have paid the bills, and no one else was hiring. You know, there was freelance, but that's like, also, how hard do you want to work to be able to pay your bills?
Right.
It's a hard, hard place. And that's why I have so much respect and admiration for you and for all the other freelancers out there. Like, I wish that I was in a place now where I could hire more of you, but my hands are tied. There's some legislation in California that makes it hard. There's obviously the impact of the pandemic on multiple publications that have closed a lot of doors to freelancers, and no one feels more helpless to help than I do right now. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there are other people who feel equally shitty, but it's a bad time. But yeah, so the fine folks at Adult Video News sent me home with a copy editing test and wanted a writing sample. So they sent me a press release for a new product. You can use your imaginations on what that product was.
All right.
And I had to write a story.
How did that
about said product?
How was that?
I wrote it. I was blushing the entire time because I'm a modest person.
Yeah.
Okay. I can, just do the job.
Compartmentalize.
So that happened.
Did you get an offer? Did it work out?
I am proud to report that the Hollywood Reporter called me back and offered me a job to come back, because when I left, they were in the process of kind of merging everything and laying off everyone. And I think when I got laid off, I was in like the 8th round of layoffs. I can't, you know, it was really bad. And I remember at the time we had the news desk, which had all of those great all-star people on it. And then there was a features department that was separate that had its own copy desk of 4 people plus a listings editor for like all the different film festivals and different, you know, different markets. And they had gutted that department from 5 people to 1 person doing all the copy editing and all the listings. And that one person, Pete Keeley, great, great guy, who's now one of the copy desk chief for THR.com, got fed up and's like, nope, I'm out. So they called me back for that job. Yeah. And that was around the same time. Literally, the calls came in maybe 2 or 3 hours apart when Adult Video News called me back to offer me the job as managing editor of AVN.
Thanks, but no thanks.
And AVN, funnily enough, paid more.
Yeah, okay.
So, you know, THR called me back, you know, and of course I took the job coming back, and it was a pay reduction, you know, because it was obviously in the middle of the recession.
Yep.
And they came up a little bit to where I came back for less than what I was making before. I had just gotten a big raise, you know, maybe a month or two before I got laid off. So yeah, it was, you know, a period that I call fun employment. So yes. I come back on, you know, on the features desk, but I kept freelancing. And that was one of my stipulations for coming back for a pay cut, was that they left the door open for me to continue contributing to all the LGBTQ outlets that I had set up. And so I would edit stuff during the day. And, you know, if I had an interview to do, I would do it during my lunch hour, or I'd go down, like I've done, I remember interviewing Anthony Rapp, who was part of the original cast of Rent. And I remember interviewing him from my car on a side street on around the corner from the Wilshire office of THR.
Speakerphone, recorder in one hand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I kept doing that. And at that point, you know, as the years went by, Janice Min came in and refashioned THR from a daily publication into a weekly publication. It was a massive change with obviously new ownership. She was adding staff. One of the people that she hired was Lacey Rose, who is now THR's executive editor of television and someone that I consider my mentor and friend. And I kept writing, and they, you know, when Lacey came in, you know, I think she was there for maybe a week, and definitely was already in the middle of like closing her first cover story, overwhelmed. And I like approached her in the hallway and I'm like, "Hi, I'm Leslie. You don't know me. I work over around the corner in the features department as a copy editor, but I want to be a TV reporter." And she's just like, "Okay, thanks. That's a lot of information." Mm-hmm. I'm overwhelmed, already, you know, kind of filed away. And she did mention, she's like, "I've read your byline." And I'm just like, "Wait, what? I haven't written for THR. You know, like I've maybe done like one or two things. Like, you know, Cynthia Littleton sent me to the Creative Arts Emmys, which if you're a TV reporter, that's literally the worst assignment you can have. That show used to be like 5 hours on like a Saturday. It was like one of the most boring assignments you could possibly ever have. And now it's like over like this year, I think it was virtual, but held over like 3 or 4 nights. Like it's truly...
I haven't had the pleasure.
Impossible. Yeah. No. You shouldn't.
Yeah.
But yeah. And, you know, a couple months went by and
she had read your, freelance stuff.
She had read my freelance stuff. Yeah. And she had looked me up and came back to me. And, you know, by that point we had, you know, lost a number of staff members. Obviously Nellie and Cynthia had all gone Deadline, and James Hibbard, who was also a THR as a great TV reporter, had gone to Entertainment Weekly, and there was a need. And, you know, it was right around the time of Comic-Con, and they had negotiated to do a Comic-Con standalone issue guest edited by Jon Favreau. And I pitched her, like, what if we open that section with, you know, like a roundup of, you know, like a poll, a survey, basically, like, oh, what panel would you stand in line all day to see? Or if you were going to dress up in costume to avoid being recognized, who would you dress as?
And, right.
You know, kind of, you know, stuff like that. And I pitched a list. And I'm like, you know, these are the 40 people that I would go out to. And they came back and they said, do it. And I'm just like, okay, hi, I have no experience. And I'm like Googling like everything. I'm like, who is the press person for Zach Levi? You know,
right.
Or who's on, you know, how do I get in touch with Felicia Day? And, you know, who's Nathan Fillion? How do I get, you know? And I wound up doing 40 interviews in something like 35 days or something insane like that. And I had said, like, well, let's take, you know, the best pieces and put them in, you know, in this roundup, but then we'll do like a whole lead up. Like, let's do like 30 days to Comic-Con and we'll do a Q&A, including all this stuff for online. And it worked out really, really well. And I had kind of started picking up press releases during the day, you know, they have moved my desk from the copy desk to right in front of Lacey. And she gave me like an old printout of the TV Critics Association press tour. It was like a packet. And they used to have a list of like publicists representing each show that was going to be a tour. And So I would just email them like, oh, I get a press release, and she'd forward it to me, and she's like, write this up. And it's like Oxygen, Green Lights, you know, some show you've never heard of.
Barely heard of, yeah.
You know, whatever. And I just write it up, and it was great experience, but I was also filling a need. And, you know, I remember it being maybe 2 days or the day before I was going to leave to go cover Comic-Con in San Diego. And Janice called me into her office. And if you've ever worked for Janice, getting called into her office is beyond intimidating. It was like that day that I got called into HR, you know, right. When I got laid off, I was like, oh my God,
flashbacks.
Oh my God, oh my yeah. God, oh my God. She hasn't even spoken with me yet. And she's calling me into her office. What have I done? What have I done? Oh my God. And I walk in there and she had printed out the masthead and showed me, pointed to my name, and it was not listed under copy editor. It was listed as TV staff writer.
Wow.
And wow. I almost pissed my pants.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's a crazy way to get that news. And so that was the official shift of
that was the official shift.
This is what you're doing now. This is what you're doing now.
And I just remember, you know, some of the best advice that Lacey gave me in the weeks leading up to that was figure out what you want this job to be and then do that. And as someone who loved television, and having gotten to edit all of those stories over the years from Nellie and Cynthia and everyone who came after them, learning about what development and upfronts was and how shows get made, whether it's scripted or unscripted, and how the business works, and learning who all the executives are and all the producers and all these other things. That's what I wanted to do because, you know, like, how did Happy Days get made? You know, that, like, reading about that, it was like super fun when I was a young kid. And, you know, now I'm the person that's responsible for actually writing and reporting those things. And it was just like,
pinch me.
Yeah, it was a pinch me moment for sure. I still have the printout.
I hope you have that framed or locked away safely somewhere. I mean,
that's
where it ought to be. That's incredible. That period of 35-ish days of like interviewing 40 people
I tormented a group of interns with transcription. Yeah. That's what I remember. I was like, I got another one. They're like, But I will say that whenever Lacey did an interview, this was like she had just started and it was like hero worship. You know, she came in from Forbes and had been doing this a long time. And I was just so envious. I'm like, how does she report all these stories? Like, how does she get these people to say these things? And, you know, she would give me interviews that she did and just to listen to. And I would volunteer to transcribe her interviews and I would learn from the way that she interviewed. And like, you know, she used to tell me like before I would do like an interview with a showrunner and, you know, she's like, figure out what you want them to say and then ask a question that gets them there. And if it doesn't work, come at it a different angle. And I would hear her do it when I would transcribe stuff. And it was like a masterclass. She's, you know, I've gotten to listen to people like Lacey and Stephen Galloway, do their interviews. And this is when I was Stephen's copy editor back in the features department after I got rehired. And they are some of the best interviewers you'll ever hear. You can obviously go watch, you know, Hollywood Reporter's roundtables and you can see it firsthand. But as a young journalist and aspiring reporter, hearing that at a time before there was roundtables and stuff like that, like it was invaluable, like some of the best stuff that I've ever heard. And, you know, when THR we used to do these intern talks in the before times when you had offices and could all gather in the same room. And I would tell the interns, like, you know, one of the first things that you're assigned to do as an intern is to help with transcription. I would just say, look, it's a grunt job. It's awful. No one wants to transcribe, but find the value in whatever the job is, no matter how menial it is, especially if it's transcription, especially if it's someone who's a master interviewer like Lacey. Volunteer for those jobs. Say yes to everything, you know, because that's what I did, you know, in my early reporting career.
I was doing a lot of, I mean, I jumped pretty quickly into just like doing my own interviews. And they were all very bad, especially when I started deciding like, all right, well, I'll deviate from this pre-written script that I've come up with and I'll I'll make it up as I go. And I have a few early stories of the nightmares that occurred from from trying to riff. It didn't go so well. And I definitely feel like my skills as an interviewer took a very sharp tick upward when I was at MTV. And I was transcribing a lot of like, you know, lots of like video clips of interviews for like breakout stories that we would have of like, this is, you know, we just interviewed Chris Evans for something and he's just been cast as Captain America. Let's bang that out as its own little breakout story. And I would learn so much just from listening to the way like Josh Horowitz interviewed people, for example. And so I do like just hearing you say that just kind of reinforces something that I have always felt about people who are right now like trying to become up and coming reporters and in this space, like listen and watch interviews, in addition to read as much as you can, but listening, to the cadence and watching the way that people, develop that rapport in a moment. Cause oftentimes you have so little time to develop
and the phrasing
that.
Of the question, you know, like everyone kind of prepares some talking points in advance, you know, you do your research, but it really, you know, how you approach that question, you can either shut someone down or have them open up right away.
I've had both.
And when you say like, you know, read everything you can, like that's what I did, you know, when I was reporting, you know, rewriting press releases, the first thing that I would do if it was a story that I was writing or a story I wasn't, I would go back and I would read the people who, A, were doing the jobs that I wanted to be, the people that I looked up to. So Nelly and Cynthia, right? I read all their stuff as a copy editor, but now when I'm writing the story, the same story that they are, if I'm on the same embargo, you know, the first thing that I did really early in my career, and I still do this, is I'll go back and read and say like, oh, was there a piece? Is there an angle that I missed?
How did they cover a thing that you also covered?
Yeah. What was their headline? You know, and, you know, for consumer stuff, one of the big ways that helped me get promoted off the copy desk, one of the big things was covering Glee. You know, and that show was a global phenomenon. And when it broke out, we didn't have anyone to cover like a consumer thing. Whereas you were my go-to, I brought you in because, you know, my editor at the time, Matt Bellany called me into his office. He said, Game of Thrones is the number one show on everyone's website except ours. Fix that. And that's how you came into my orbit.
Someone to talk about dragons. It's like, hey, I can do that. I'll do
it. You are my dragon master, right? You're my dragon. Like, I don't know.
I don't know. We don't need to get into the weeds on that. I'm glad you brought up Glee because I know Glee is like really central to like the next evolution point of your career, right? I feel like this is a show that you are covering at that. Would you say at that level that I was covering Game of Thrones for you when Game of Thrones was on?
I mean, I was up. I tried to be. I mean, it was hard. I mean, I remember at the time, Tim Stack felt like he had at Entertainment Weekly, he felt like he had Ryan Murphy on speed dial.
Yeah.
You know, every Glee exclusive was on EW. It was the biggest show on the planet. It was a global hit. And I just remember getting the opportunity to go to set as part of like a press junket and, you know, doing red carpet events with the cast and, you know, setting up phoners with everyone every week. And then, you know, watching on Slingbox and having to recap and learning how to get to write a story in real time, and which was a whole other experience of Deadline, where you're watching this episode and you have to write about it in real time and figure out what the headline is, what the key moment is, what the picture should be, and how to do it all without spoiling anything, and how to do that and have the story up within like 5 minutes after the episode ends. You know, and
it's a lot.
And then it's like working relationships with publicists and getting, you know, like pitching yourself like, hey, we really want to do this. You know, is this person available? And you build a rapport, not just with the cast and the producers, but also with the publicists, not just for the show, but for the individual talent and just all these different ways of covering a show. And it was a mini lesson in how to cover a bigger beat, you know, and when you're covering a development beat, you know, for what I do now, it's like, you're covering networks and streamers and executives and showrunners and cancellations. And, you know, I always say, and I'm sure you've heard me say this before, but now this job is like juggling blowtorches and you just hope that you don't get burned by one. And at the time working Glee, it's like you learn how to like, hey, you know, here you have set up a weekly conversation with a publicist and say, these are the kind of things that we want to do or what's coming up. What should we be doing? I know you can't say a whole lot, but, you know, we want to cover it weekly in depth. You know, what are the angles? Oh, you should reach out to this person because that's, you know, they have a big episode coming up. So just kind of set that up, you know, and it was a crash course in how to cover a beat and how to be stressed out all the time. Because it's like you're on watch, and anytime someone says something, you're aggregating another interview, or if there's a big casting that breaks elsewhere, learning how to confirm news and, you know, not just watch, you know, it's like when the network used, when Fox used to send out like, oh, here's upcoming storylines. You like scroll down, where's Glee? And you're like, okay, are there any guest castings that haven't been announced? Or is there any big storyline that could be its own breakout? Or you get a screener in advance and you learn how to write a preview without spoiling anything. And yeah, it was a whole, like, it's a whole subset of skills that you learn on the fly.
Yeah. What were some of the other shows that you were covering as you became official TV writer at the Hollywood Reporter? What are some of the ones that stand out as either most enjoyable, most memorable, anything like that?
Well, THR really needed me to cover Glee. So that was, you know, I watched the pilot like everybody else did and was like, wow, this show is awesome. And it just was, you know, as a musical theater nerd, like I loved the pilot, and being asked to cover it was, yes, an assignment, but also like, oh, really? Yeah, sure. Okay, sure. Like, yeah. You want me to do what? Yeah, okay. I'm here for that. And then, you know, they really kind of left it up to me. And, you know, at the time, I loved Grey's Anatomy. I still do. And I just started writing about Grey's. And it was basically they trusted my news judgment after it kind of showed that I had the, you know, that I was able to cover a show like Glee every week. And that was a learning experience. You know, I still have some nightmare stories from that. And, you know,
not fit for podcasting.
I mean, I remember doing an interview with Ryan Murphy and asking him, there were all these rumors at the time that, you know, of cast departures, and asking him about the cast departures. And he said, oh yeah, they're not returning. And I was like, wait, what? Like, and I ran the story and he called me back screaming and the story went viral. And then I think a few days later, I had to go to Comic-Con, and Glee was a last minute addition in Hall. It was either Hall H or Ballroom 20. I can't remember.
One of them for sure, though.
Definitely one of the big ones. And this is at the height of its popularity. And I remember, you know, sitting in the audience and the moderator, Michael Osiello, who's, if you want to learn how to do consumer show coverage, follow him and watch how he positions his stories. Because that's how
as a reader, he was my master. Yeah, I would say.
Right. Yeah. Because if you're covering consumer stuff, he was the king of that. You know, and the way he positioned stories, you know, at the time, that's how I learned a lot of it. And, I just remember Osiello asking, Brad Falchuk was up there, the co-creator, and, you know, he asked Brad, he's like, you know, Ryan Murphy just gave this interview and said that these cast members are not returning. And Falchuk said, yeah, Ryan told me he never said that to that. You know, he never told her that. Didn't mention me by name, but obviously I'm like sitting there. I'm like, I'm covering, I'm reporting on this. And the story that I wrote is the headline. And I'm just like shaking.
Yeah.
And then like I get the story out and I'm just like, oh fuck, you know, and I'd rewritten most of it because, you know, the Wi-Fi at Comic-Con is the Wi-Fi at Comic-Con.
Right.
Or used to be when there used to be a Comic-Con.
Legendarily bad for those who've
legendarily
never been.
Epically bad.
Yes.
And, you know, you're sitting there squeezed in with 7,000 reporters who are lucky enough to get a press pass that you had to beg, borrow, and steal to get. And I'm just shaking. I'm like, I filed the story and I'm just like, I now have to go to the Glee press room. And I'm shaking. I am totally shaking. And I had just met my wife at the time, or obviously, she wasn't my wife, but I just met Natalie, who is
fellow reporter at the time.
Natalie Abrams, who was a reporter at TVGuide.com when we first started seeing each other. And I had read her before we even met because she covered Glee and she covered Grey's Anatomy. And as a TV fan, she was writing about all my favorite shows. And I remember when I was a copy editor, I'm like, she's doing the job that I want. Like, I want to be doing what she's doing. And, you know, we had met at a Showtime red carpet Emmy party. And we started seeing each other in August. So we're maybe, and Comic-Con is July. So we're maybe about a year
close
into our relationship. And just, I just remember thinking, I'm like, I'm going to quit my job because Ryan Murphy is screaming at me. And, you know, maybe I don't have what it takes to do this. And, you know, and I just remember calling Natalie, and she actually called me. She's like, I just heard what happened on the, you know, in the Glee thing. Cause I don't know if she wasn't there. She was somewhere else at Comic-Con. I can't remember.
But she'd heard. She'd found out.
Yeah. Obviously, it was huge news.
Yeah.
And she's like, are you okay? Cause she knew how hard I was you know, like she knew all the doubt, you know, self-doubt that I had. And I'm like, I'm like in tears and I'm shaking. I'm like, I have to go to the Glee press room right now. Like, and she's like, you got this. You know, she was always and forever and remains my biggest champion and me, her. And, you know, I want to come back because I definitely would not have been able to tolerate the stress and the learning curve of this job without her in my corner. Yeah. And I know she's, you know, if by some wing and a prayer, she's listening to this, I just want to say, I love you. And I'm grateful every day that you stood by me when I was a wreck. And, I
she's
just remember
an
that call.
Incredible human, incredible,
just
human.
An amazing human and obviously biased, but, just a you little. Know, I just remember calling, she's like, you got this. Just, you know, you're a professional. You are good at this job. This is the job that you want. It's a job that you love. Just go in there and hold your ground. You know what happened. It doesn't matter anything else. You know what happened. And I'm like, okay. So I go in there and I sit down and Dan Feinberg, who was at HitFix at the time, is at my table. And the first person to sit down for the Glee roundtable and in the press room was Brad Falchuk. And he's like, I'm sorry to do that to you. You know, but Ryan told me he never said those things. And I'm like, I understand. And I just went ahead with the questions that I had prepped for him and the stories that I planned to write. And Feinberg, God bless him, at the time was, you know, he's like, he wound up writing an entire story and he asked Brad all about all these other things. And he wrote a whole story of, she published the entire Q&A. Here's Ryan Murphy's Q&A. Here's, you know, Brad, you know, like this XYZ. And I remember after the Glee press room, it was a little last thing that I had to do at Comic-Con, met back up with Natalie and we got out of there and we're in the car when all of a sudden I started getting all these text messages and it was everyone sending me Dan's story. He had published a whole thing about the press room and the apology that happened and said, stand by and I wish the story still existed on HitFix, but I think, you know, the entire backlog of HitFix is no more, but
missed.
And I just remember, and I was friendly with Dan at the time, but that just forever just locked in my heart. And, I'm lucky to have him as a friend and as a co-host for our podcast. And, that was a day, a week. And then the following Monday after Comic-Con, it was like the next day, Ryan Murphy gave an interview to Deadline and said, yeah, I did say those things.
All right. Yeah. Yeah. That's how that goes. Yeah. For sure. When you've got the receipts and then B, people in the industry. I mean, it's a small industry, you know?
Yeah. It really is when you think about it, even though it's massive, you wind up working with a lot of the same people, you know, even as the jobs change or the outlets change. So.
Yeah. I don't want to yada yada to your current working relationship with the great Dan Feinberg. If there's more that you want to talk about, I would love to know how you then get from, writing on the TV side to then you're in charge of live feed, creating live feed, launching live feed. What's the story behind that?
James Hibbard launched it and okay. I was happy to contribute to it. At the time, you know, we had overlap is when I was a copy editor and obviously, but we never got to work side by side as reporters. But I will say he remains one of the greats and
I have his book on my shelf, Fire
Me
Cannot
too, as
Kill
do
a
I.
Dragon. Yeah.
Autographed. And,
fancy. I'm going to send this back.
But it's just, the transition, I was hired to do both things, the consumer coverage and the breaking news coverage because they needed someone. You know, TV was exploding at the time and not nearly the way it has, but it was at the beginnings of peak TV. And, you know, they needed someone to do all of it. And, the years went on, you keep doing breaking news stuff and you build a Rolodex of sources and you build relationships with PR and studios and executives and you start breaking more TV news and obviously more shows keep coming in and I would, just ask, say, hey, I want to, cover this or, there's more things to do. And eventually they started seeing like there's a lot more traffic that can come from covering a show on the consumer side, not just a renewal or a casting type thing where it's talent interviews or exclusive clips or analysis. And at a certain point, as I continued to get promoted from staff writer, you know, they came in, Lacey came in and said, you know, we want you and Matt and said, we want you to oversee this. You have the ability to hire freelancers and we trust your news judgment when it comes to what shows we're going to cover and how we're going to cover them. And it was a lot. And we want you to continue to do reporting. That's obviously the first, you know, first and foremost, number one priority. And, you know, continue to cover breaking news and analysis and keep doing what you're doing, but also, you know, let's get you some support. And, you know, I was able to work with and hire people like you, Josh, and, you know, the great Gene Bentley, who's become a good friend too, is one of our current freelancers for live feed and working with just a lot of great voices. And, you know, you try and hire more people and it becomes, you know, it's very competitive, you know, with a rate, and sometimes it doesn't always work out or the timing doesn't work out, or, you know, it's a hard thing to juggle. And, you know, especially in this climate where there's 8,000 shows and, you know, how you get someone or access that you can get. And it's just, it's incredibly competitive. And there's, you know, just within THR, there's, you know, a handful of different things. Like you could have 5 or 6 people interview the same person for 5 or 6 different things. You know, like you, Josh, you just oversaw our coverage of Lovecraft Country, right? Like working with our writer, Richard Newby, who you helped bring in to cover for that, which is an incredible thing that you did. And Richard interviewed the showrunner for Lovecraft. Dan and I had her on our podcast. Mikey O'Connell just interviewed her for our showrunner's issue. I'm sure at some point later down the line, she's going to wind up doing Scott Feinberg's podcast, Awards Chatter, when it's closer to Emmys next year. You know, she'll wind up being on a roundtable, I'm sure, at some point or another. That's a Lacey interview. Yeah.
It's a good snapshot into like how that's just internally within the Hollywood Reporter.
And that's just a THR.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's really competitive to land interviews of that scale right now.
Yeah. And that's just one outlet.
Yeah.
I'm very lucky to have the opportunity to do everything that I'm doing. But, you know, covering the TV industry right now is bonkers. You know, during the pandemic, obviously the production side, we've got the great Bryn Sandberg, who covers a lot of the production stuff, and the impact of the shutdown and shows getting unrenewed or dropped entirely and never even debuting, or, you know, actors dropping out because they either don't feel safe or, you know, for whatever reasons, or they don't want to travel.
Production shifting, releases shifting.
Yeah, the
left
calendar.
And right.
Like I was just talking, you know, getting to the end of the year, and I usually do this story about the most anticipated new shows coming in the year ahead. And I'm just like, oh my God, how am I going to do that? Like, no one's going to have dates locked in, right? Like, I think Why the Last Man has been on that list the last 2 years.
A long time.
Right. And, you know,
we should talk about this one offline. I'll help you out.
I have a feeling that's a Josh Wigler show.
I have a feeling that's a Josh Wigler show too.
And the executive changes, it's like this industry has changed so much in 2020 that I can't even put words to it. Like, it's just,
it's
insane.
A really hard time to break in for a lot of reasons. Like, it's a hard, like, you would think that peak TV would make it easier to break in. I think in some ways it makes it harder because it becomes a more competitive landscape, but then also factor in everything that's happened over the last 8 or so months now. And it's just like, it's a completely different world. I like everything that you just listed out. And then I'm also thinking on top of that of like the literal ways in which each individual person's life has completely been upended by everything. You know, like working from home, not having that day to day, not seeing that murderer's row of copy editing desks at THR. What are some of the ways in which that's impacted you and how you do your job, having to do this now completely remotely?
I miss people. You know, obviously working from home, and you know, there's no industry lunches with sources. There's no parties to go, you know, elbow, you know, with executives, or there's just nothing. Everything is remote, and, you know, it makes it harder to break news because you're, you know, if my wife's on a Zoom in the other room, maybe my Wi-Fi is a little slower, or, you know, we're sitting here recording this show and I just had to send an embargo, you know, to a colleague to cover. You know, and everyone's doing 7,000 other things and no one has any idea what anyone's doing most of the day or what their availability is, because you can't walk out into the newsroom and say, oh, where's Lacey? I need to talk to her about this other thing, or, you know, who's available to grab this, you know, and it's just, you know, it makes it harder to get people to return your calls because they're dealing with the same thing. And a lot of people, you know, have kids that they're dealing with homeschooling. And it's just, I can't even, like, it's just, you know, some days you get up, you roll out of bed, throw on a pair of track pants. I am wearing track pants and a hoodie. And, you know, hop on 17 back-to-back Zooms.
I'm wearing
Zooms,
the same hoodie,
like,
I was wearing when we spoke yesterday. So, you know.
Thanks. So am I, Josh.
That's where we're at.
It lives on the back of this fine office chair that we've just procured from Costco. You know, it's just, it's, you know, sometimes you miss the motivation. You know, it's hard to go out and meet new people. You know, if you're trying to, you know, get a new source, you're setting up an, you know, the most awkward, like, Zoom calls, you know, and, you know, if you're making calls, you're just like, oh, you know, I need to talk to this agent for a story. You know, it's due tomorrow and I have all this other stuff going on at home, or this, you know, maybe that person's not available because they have things that they're dealing with at home, or, you know, we'll be recording the podcast and the gardener shows up, or, you know, there was one day I was doing an interview with Darren Starr for print, and we must have gotten 5 deliveries. And so you've got FedEx people ringing the little doorbell, and we have a dog, and the dog's going nuts. And you're just like, hi, Darren Starr, please don't judge me. I have a yappy dog, you know? It's just, you know, everything's
harder.
I have
found people to be more forgiving in that regard.
Everyone's
though,
totally
right now,
forgiving,
like,
but it's still not, you know.
It's uncomfortable. It stinks. Yeah.
You have a set of professional standards that you want to uphold, and you want things to go smoothly, and you don't want to interrupt, and you don't want to risk losing a rhythm of an interview.
Sure,
or
yeah,
they're on one thought and you get interrupted and they lose it and you're like, you know. And
yeah, absolutely.
Everything's just harder and it takes longer because, you know, mentally you're dealing with, hi, I'm still doing this from home because I'm afraid to go to the supermarket. And there's also an election and there's stress from that. And, you know, internal politics, you know, THR's just had an ownership changeover and we've had rounds of layoffs. And it's 2020 sucks, man.
2020
it's just
sucks.
Everything about it sucks. Like, I would love to go back to the before and where you're complaining about there being too much TV. I will never complain about there being too much TV to cover ever again, because let's let those people get their job, keep their jobs. Let's keep production running safely. Let's get everyone healthy and let's get back into the office and, you know, be able to see everyone's nose and mouth when they speak.
One way in which 2020 has not sucked is, as you mentioned before, Dan Feinberg, your co-host on TV's Top 5. So for people who don't know, Leslie does a weekly show on The Hollywood Reporter. It's called TV's Top 5. Incredible podcast. I remember asking you the other week. We were having a conversation the other week, and I was like, because I want to start, and I think that this is a lot under your guidance as well, like getting me feeling a little more comfortable in industry reporting, because it's a blind spot for me. I'm not well versed in like the language, the history of it, nearly to the extent that I feel I need to be. And I asked you for like reading recommendations, like is there a hack? Like, how do I? And you gave me a really strong recommendation of books, and I bought them all. But you were like, listen to our podcast. Listen to the, like, you know, because we're covering what's happening in the industry right now. And not that I ever for a second, even for a microsecond would have doubted like yours and Dan's shared expertise. Dan being somebody who I first met on a set going on like 11 or 12 years ago now. But like hearing the full journey of how you got to where you are with TV's Top 5 having launched within the last 2-3 years, something like that. There is just such a wealth of lived in experience and information packed into that podcast each and every week, with interviews with showrunners too. So you're getting that as well, with a different showrunner basically every single week at this point.
I'm just going to hire you to be my hype man from now on, Josh.
Listen, if there's more money in it, I'm there. I'll also do it for free.
I will say, you know, of the things that I've been lucky enough to do in my career and all the various set visits and stories and interviews,
I know that this is like your happy
doing the
place.
Podcast has been, you know, and remains my most favorite thing that I've done in my career. And it's just getting to talk every week about TV and making sense of the headlines and what's going on in the industry at a time of when it's changing so rapidly, and getting to talk to both established and new and up and coming showrunners, and getting turned on to shows that I never would have sampled before, let alone binge the entire season of it. You know, doing the show has been an absolute blessing. And the end of the year, we're coming up on episode 100. We just had an exclusive interview with the Dexter showrunner about the revival. That was a really cool thing to book, because Dexter was one of the first shows that I covered way back in the day. And that was a relationship that I built, you know, 10 years ago that has survived because we've stayed in touch, you know, and not just like, oh, I saw you sign something, you know, congrats. How have you been? How's your family? You know, and, you know, the guiding rule of my career has always been, you know, there's twofold. It's, you know, figure out what you want this job to be and then do that, which is what Lacey taught me, and to treat people the way you want to be treated. And that's the same with, you know, if you're talking to a showrunner or an agent or a publicist or an actor, and, you know, a kindness goes a long way. And, you know, one story can be fleeting because you can hit publish on it and then it gets aggregated around the world. And then all the effort that you pumped into that is gone. But if you forge the relationship while you're doing it, that lasts a long time. And that's that's how we booked the Dexter showrunner, when everyone was asking for the same one.
Yeah.
So
also, you'll forget the story that you wrote. I'm sure that you, at least if it were
me.
A
lot of them, I go back and, you know, there was, I want to say maybe last year or the year before, I went back, in the Wayback Machine and read like one of my first breaking news stories that I did for THR. And I'm just
why would you do that to yourself? Don't do that to yourself.
Oh my goodness.
It's no good. It's no good. But yeah, I think that's something that I've really learned from you is that piece of it. Because I think for me, my career is, marked by like, a year actively at a magazine where half of it was spent in some form of customer service. And then, the next half was in editorial. And then from there, that's like right around the same exact time as the recession that I leave, and I hit the freelance trenches. And so my entire career to some degree or another has been freelance. And as you know, from that period of time that you were describing earlier, that's just type.
Yeah, you're the Kermit GIF. Yeah.
You know, you really are. And so the relationship management piece of it, for me has actually often been a struggle, because I am just like, so, even like the reading piece of it and like taking in new information and seeing what everybody else is doing can be difficult, because especially in the early days of myself as a freelancer, it was just type from sunup to sundown. And that was my life for like a solid 5 years. And I think that it's something I wish that I had recognized earlier on in my career, of like, take a breath and don't just like hit record and start interviewing. Like maybe like ask, how are you okay? You know, like, what's going on? How are you feeling? And, I have really felt my own work both at the Hollywood Reporter. So like my work in terms of like my career as a writer and as a reporter, but also my work here as a podcaster, I have felt a dramatically sharp increase in quality personally, with that stuff, largely because of, I think, a lot of the things that you're just talking about, which you have imparted to me, like every conversation we ever have, I feel like, it is something we're always going back to.
For sure. I think because the first thing, even when we talk just for a check-in, you know, like set up a call, like, oh, what's coming up? You know, how are we going to cover this show XYZ? You set up a planning call, but always, you know, the first part of that conversation that we have is always kind of just a check-in, because, you know, to me, it's, you're giving me such a value in your skills, right? You provide so much help and, you know, like you're my go-to when you know, the biggest genre shows out there, right? Game of Thrones, Stranger Things, Handmaid's Tale. Like I can name like a bunch more that you've covered and covered extremely well, better than I would have if I was going to be in that position. And you're, you know, you bring that skill set and you make our website better and you make my job easier, because we've developed a shorthand through a relationship where we've learned how to communicate and you've learned what kind of stories that I want for THR, and you've learned how to deliver those. But what makes it more important is, when you're working so closely with someone, you're going to build those relationships, and you should build those relationships, because I want to instill confidence in you. I want you to want to do your best work for me, but it's also, I want it to feel like a collaboration. Like you're getting something out of this too. Like maybe I have, you know, learned to do something, you know, where I've imparted some, like you walk away from this relationship better than how you've had, than with a skill that maybe you didn't have before, you know, and that's, you know, I've learned that from Lacey, you know, I've learned that, you know, from all the people that have come before. And, you know, a lot of being a reporter in the peak TV era comes with being a self-starter, right? You have to figure out what the big story is to be. You have to allocate, you have to figure out how, you know, how to allocate your time. Time management is such a vital part of this job and yours too, even as a freelancer, right? Like, you know, one of the things that Natalie taught me really early in my career is, you know, on the consumer side, you pump in as much time on a story as you think people will read, right? Like if you think no one's going to read this, then maybe, you know, you don't need to put 7 hours of research or reporting into it, you know, or, you know, and we've all published things that, you know, like, you know, one of the running gags that we have is, you know, like, oh, this one's a real Pulitzer, you know, where it's like, oh, I just got to get the story out. I have too many other things on my plate. I can't go, you know, do a sentence of context instead of maybe an entire paragraph or two. You know,
there is a skill though to like being able to just like live with something you've done.
Right. But there is. Yeah. Like, you know, if you're doing it, you know, an oral history, that's huge, you know,
you want to put a lot of, you know, but like if it's, you know, sometimes like I have to write this and I just have to live with it. And then it is what it is. You know, there's a bit of skill involved in like mentally breaking past that barrier of like, this just needs to exist and I need to make it exist so that I can go on and do the thing that's a lot more important.
Right. And there's also the ability of saying, you know, maybe that's not, you know, you and I have had these conversations like, oh, I'm going to scrap this because, you know, this part didn't work out and I started writing it and it just didn't feel like the right angle. So I'm going to do this instead. Or I wound up being too busy with this other thing that I know is a higher priority and this other thing that maybe is something I really wanted to do. Maybe that can wait. You know, it's, you know, having the good lines of communication and having that trust, not just with your editor, but with your other colleagues, that goes such a long way. You know, keep the lines of communication open. And you know, as journalists, the joke is we're all, you know, we're paid to be communicators, but we're the worst at it. You got to work double time to make sure that you're actually good at it.
Yeah, no, that is very true. You know, it is such a hard time and we're living in a world where like everything is changing a mile a minute. And I think as we've talked about a couple of times here that I think breaking in right now is really difficult. But I'm sure that there are people who are listening to this who I know that there are because there are people who I talk to, who I either work with closely here on the podcast or people who I know who listen to the podcast who are constantly like, this is an area that I would love to, you know, carve some ground into. Do you have any advice for anybody at this moment in time of like, what do you do? How do you break in? Is it just the wrong time or is it a matter of like, finding like the soft spot and like, this is something I can, is it timing? Is it luck? What would you say to somebody who's trying to break into this world right now?
I mean, it's hard, not just like I said, because of the, you know, THR is based in California. So there's, you know, legislation that limits the use of freelancers and every outlet under the sun, I would imagine right now has budgetary constraints and maybe close to freelancers. It's a hard time, you know, fiscally right now. But one of the things that I used to say in our intern talks that I still believe in is if no one's going to pay you to write the story, write it anyway. You know, it's super easy to launch a blog, right? You know, if no one's going to pay you to build the clips, build them anyway, build your own blog. So you have some writing samples like, oh, you know, I know content aggregation is a big thing, right? I want to show that I can write a breaking news story. Here's, you know, I started this website and maybe you get some people reading it and you build a name for yourself, you know, do it. I used to post shit on MySpace. That's how old I am. MySpace or Friendster. Remember that thing? Like I would post stories like that because I just wanted to write them before anyone would pay me to do them. And you have the opportunity to do that and, you know, build a conversation, you know, read the people who are doing the jobs that you want to be doing. That's what I did. I read Natalie before we even started dating because she was covering all these shows in such a cool way. And I was like, how did she get that? Like, oh, I see how she positioned that quote. Or, you know, it's like you can look at a story and say, oh, that was a notebook dump, you know, or maybe they had this quote left over and they decided to hold it back from a full Q&A to do a breakout story. Oh, I get that. That's like you get two different hits out of one interview, right? And that's something that I do all the time. Other tons of reporters do that, you know. Or if you want to cover breaking news, read the people. I know you just raise your hand. You do that,
yeah,
like
yeah.
we all do. And yeah. you know, if you want to cover breaking news, read the people who are doing it, and then try your hand at it yourself. And close the window. Like read, you know, like oh, this thing just got picked up. Find the information. Close the window. Or get a copy of the press release. You can always find the press releases. There's a lot of great sites. I think Futon Critic publishes a lot of press releases that get sent out through the industry. You know, practice makes perfect. That's what I learned it by doing it for SheWired. You know, if THR or Deadline or Variety or EW or any one of the, you know, the entertainment blogs would publish something that had any kind of an angle for the LGBTQ TV industry, I'm like, oh, they positioned it this way because it's like a straight trade story. I can position it in a way that where it's the right fit for a queer blog, right? You know, like, oh, you know, Grey's Anatomy to introduce, you know, second lesbian character or whatever, you know, like that's a different angle than a different outlet would have. You yeah. can tailor stuff for the angle, you know, for the outlet, you know, and, you know, I remember, you know, when a cast member for Walking Dead, you know, got, you know, booked another show, the first thing you and I would do would be like, oh, you know, this okay, person so is going to star in this thing. What does it mean for them on Walking Dead? You know, right, like there's right, other right. angles that you can hit. And
yeah.
And in terms of breaking in, I don't know, man, it's hard. It's hard out there. But, you know, the best thing to do is show that you can have something to point to, build relationships. You know, a big thing that actually helped me when I first got promoted to reporter was Twitter. I started following a lot of publicists and other writers and seeing ways that they positioned headlines or stories, or, you know, you follow enough showrunners or actors and you build a relationship, you see kind of how they really are. And maybe there's something that they tweet that's an interesting angle, you know, and there's a lot of different ways to cover it. But, you know, still, I quote Lacey a third time, figure out what you want your job to be and then do that. And if no one's going to pay you to do it anyway. Because there's so many tools out there where you can, if it's a podcast like this that you wanted to launch, there's so much more freedom to do the things that can get your voice out there and can get your byline out there. And, you know, there's, you know, people on Twitter that I read, I'm just like, oh, that's a good angle, or that, you know, and they don't even get paid to do this stuff. They're just doing it because this is the job that they want. And eventually someone's going to hire them, you yeah. know?
Yeah. Leslie, this was amazing. It was just so great to, you've been so generous with your time and to just like have over an hour of the two of us. Like, I feel like the last time we've had like a conversation this long, it was probably like almost a year ago when I was crying at like 4 a.m. on the phone with you about a thing that I don't want to talk about.
But, like, it's I'm been happy a while. There are no tears here except mine recalling my AVN, my near miss with AVN.
I can't believe that. That's absolutely incredible. But I want to thank you not just for being here, but for being in my life and showing me the way. And I think without you, I actually don't think that not just this podcast, but so many of the other podcasts that I've done are possible, because I've just been led by such a tremendous person. And you've taught me so much, and you make my life so much easier than this job wants to make it. You know what I mean? By that, like, this I know, career I, Josh, really doesn't want it to be easy, and you really make it a joy. So I really wanted to have people who listen to this podcast get to know you a little bit better. And I strongly encourage all of them, not just to read your reporting at THR, but to really listen to the podcast and also follow you at Snootit. Where does Snootit come from?
Oh God, I need to change that, but I just
no,
never.
It's
have.
Iconic. You have to keep it.
So it's a really, really old screen name. And one of my friends, we were hanging out one day with her nephew, who was, I think, 3 or at the time. And he was trying to say, we were all joking around, you know, this is embarrassing. We were listening to that like Aqua, that Barbie song.
Mm-hmm.
And he was basically like, we were all like trying to act like really conceited, you know, and he just looked at me and he goes, you're being snooted. Like, he meant to say, you're being like snooty, conceited. Mm-hmm. You're being snooted. So he just started calling me snooted, and it just stuck. So it's like a funny way of like where you're trying to be conceited, but you're really not being conceited at all. But then there's also a game called Snood, which I'm also obsessed with. And a lot of people think it's directly connected, and it's not. even though, but
you
Snood
do play Snood.
Good.
Okay. I was going to ask, like, was it because, like, you have a, should we do 90 minutes on, like, you being the secret Snood wizard?
No, definitely not. I go in waves where I'll play, like, you know, a couple of times a week, and then I just don't play it all for a few months. But it's like a good, like, you need like a mental break for me.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
Fun. But Josh, I just want to thank you, not just for your friendship, first and foremost, but just for everything that you've contributed, not just the THR, but all the ways in which you've made my life easier and you've made my job easier and all the wonderful things that you do online. I think that your ability to talk honestly and candidly about your struggles with anxiety has helped me do the same with my anxiety. You know, covering this industry right now, it's on a deadline and on a fast pace, it's a hard thing to do, especially in time, you know, in these, you know, difficult times. And I just think that you're an amazing human and a fantastic writer. And among the blessings of this job has been getting to meet you. So thank you, my friend.
This is another great example of how our conversations often end is like, you hang up. No, you hang
no,
up.
You
I
hang
love
up.
You.
No, you.
No, I love you. Like this, this is why this works. We have a lot of love for each other. So
absolutely, man. Thank you.
Such a pleasure to have you on. Go check out TV's Top 5 if you haven't done so yet. It's worth doing. Go do it.
Thanks for the plug and thanks for having me, Josh.
For sure. Thanks to Leslie Goldberg for sharing her origin story, and thank you for listening to Origin Story. If you like what you heard, please rate and review the podcast. And if you really like what you heard, consider becoming a member of the Post Show Recaps patron community at patreon.com/postshowrecaps to support shows like these and much more. We'll be back soon with another episode of Origin Story.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.